on Education for March 30th, 2015. Okay, welcome everybody on such a our last gorgeous day of spring. Well, we don't know. The first thing we're going to do, we have quite a large agenda, is the first thing we're going to do is have a work session on House Bill 3319 and House Bill 3389. Oh, we're going to do these first. Okay. On second thought, we're going to have a work session on two bills to move them to another committee. So I open up a work session on House Bill 3128.
Yes, I can. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. House Bill 3128 authorizes the State Board of Education to adopt variable ratios for funds, for local funds required to match capital grants and loans to school districts financed by Article 11P General Obligation Bonds. And the committee has been asked to move the measure to the Committee on Revenue for policy consideration.
Okay. Chair Doherty.
Is that the right number?
The right one? 3128, sorry. Sorry, just so I yeah. Got the wrong number. Chair Doherty?
Yes.
I move House Bill 3128 without recommendation to the Committee on Revenue.
Okay, Chair. Representative Frederick moves House Bill 3128 without recommendation to the Committee on Revenue. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none. Will the clerk read the roll, please?
Representative
Reddick. Aye.
Representative
Hatton.
Aye.
Representative Clayton.
Aye.
Representative
Oh, excused.
Representative
Reardon. Aye.
Representative Wilson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frederick.
Yes.
Vice Chair Springer.
Aye.
Chair Doherty.
Aye. Okay, motion passes, and it will be sent to the Committee on Revenue. Okay, with that, I close the work session on House Bill 3128 and open up a work session on House Bill 3336.
Chair Doherty.
Well, I'll have Richard explain.
Thank you, Mentor, members of the committee. House Bill 3336 also deals with some state treasurer authorization to issue Article 11P general obligation bonds. The committee has also been asked to move it this measure to the Committee on Revenue for policy consideration. It will then go to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Okay.
And I've got that one already.
Is this without recommendation? Or is this without recommendation?
Without recommendation, yes.
Chair Doherty?
Yes.
I move House Bill 3336 without recommendation to the Committee on Revenue and then to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Okay, Representative Frederick moves House Bill 3336 without recommendation to the Committee on Revenue and then to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there discussion? Okay, seeing none. Tia, could you read the roll, please?
Representative Hatton.
Aye.
Representative Clayton.
Aye.
Representative Paluzzo.
Excused.
Representative Reardon.
Aye.
Representative Wilson.
Aye.
Representative Brett.
Yes.
Aye. Vice Chair Frederick.
Yes.
Vice Chair Springer.
Aye.
Chair
Gordy. Aye. And with that, the motion passes. The measure is sent to the Committee on Revenue. And with that, I close the work session on House Bill 3336. And I open up a, what are we hearing first? Okay, what we're going to do is we're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3319.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3319 directs the Oregon Department of Education to evaluate methods to reduce dropout rates. It declares an emergency effective on passage.
Okay, so with that, okay, the speakers we have are Representative Taylor, who's there, and then we have other people, Peter Tromba, Brian Reeder, Chelsea Clinton, and Iris Maria Chavez are on here, plus others. Want to. So welcome, Representative Taylor.
Thank you.
Helicopter data.
Chair Doherty, members of the House Education Committee. I am Kathleen Taylor, State Representative for House District 41, which encompasses parts of Southeast Portland, Milwaukee, and Oak Grove. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today about House Bill 3319. I'm going to keep my comments brief in order to allow the real education experts, the professionals from the Oregon Education Investment Board, the Oregon Department of Education, and Stanford Children to provide background on this issue. Before going further, it is important to note for the committee that an amendment to House Bill 3319 is currently being drafted. This amendment will require all school districts in Oregon to report annually to the Oregon Department of Education about the methods each district has been using to address chronic absenteeism and to reduce high school dropout rates. The Oregon Department of Education will analyze this information and then come and report back to your committee, of course, about actions being taken to increase graduation and attendance rates across the state. In talking about the problem of graduation rates in Oregon, I'd like to cite a few statistics that I'm sure committee members are aware of, but that nonetheless are alarming. In 2014, nearly 3 out of 10 Oregon seniors failed to earn a diploma within 4 years. For the 2012-13 school year, Oregon had the lowest graduation rate of any state in the nation. Also, in the 2012-13 school year, approximately 100,000 students missed 3.5 weeks of school or more, over 10% of their given school days for that year. The reason for these statistics are complex, and no single method can alone fully tackle this problem. By taking the time to evaluate and disseminate the information about the most effective ways to keep our students in school and on track to graduate, we can begin the hard work of increasing Oregon's graduation rate and address the chronic absenteeism problem we have here in Oregon. The other area I'd like to address in more detail is chronic absenteeism. Approximately 100,000 students, We want to ensure that the students are receiving the instructional time they need in order to stay on track to graduate. I hope this information, the idea behind this bill is so that the Oregon Department of Education can collect this information and start to see the link and inform us better here in the legislature about the connection between lack of attendance and low graduation rates. I look forward to hearing the other testimony that our colleagues will be sharing. So,
okay, great. Are there any questions of Representative Taylor? Okay, thank you very much. Okay, do we have a sign-up sheet on this one or just? Okay, the next one we have Peter Tromba, Brian Reeder, Chelsea Clinton, or whoever else wants to come up in the next panel. Iris, did you want to come up also with this one, or you can come up by yourself, whichever you'd prefer. Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Peter Tromba, Policy and Research Director for the Oregon Education Investment Board and a former middle and high school principal in Oregon. I'm here today to testify about HB 3319, which directs the Department of Ed to evaluate methods to reduce dropout rates. The topic of reducing dropout and increasing graduation is topical in Oregon and around the country. And when you think of it, common sense backs up research, which points to the critical need for schools and districts to address this problem early. The transition from 8th to 9th grade is significant for 3 reasons. First, there's less defined structure in high school schedules as compared to middle school schedules. For instance, not every student has a full schedule in high school, and the classes they take do vary from student to student. Second, students have much more freedom to make decisions with their time. Many high schools have open campuses, and it is generally much easier to skip a class in high school than middle school. And finally, in the context of less structure and more freedom, high school is generally the first time students are held accountable for their progress. Unlike the previous 9 years of automatic grade-to-grade promotion, in high school, when students fail a class, they get no credit. They need to repeat that course, and they start to fall behind. And students who do fall behind often stay behind and do not graduate. In Oregon, we use a metric that's tuned to that idea that's called ninth grade on track. This metric is determined by credits earned and attendance. And across the country, there are similar measures. A critical national longitudinal research on this topic comes from the University of Chicago, which reports that students who end their ninth grade year on track are almost four times more likely to graduate from high school than those not on track. National data confirm this critical benchmark. Ninth grade on track is 80% predictive of graduation. So what do you do about it? Well, interventions in the ninth and tenth grade year targeted at students not on track are a best practice. For example, in the Chicago Public Schools, a major effort starting in 2007 centered on keeping more ninth graders on track. And since that time, CPS has risen 25% in on track and have seen an attendance significant increase in graduation rates. While ninth grade on track is a broadly adopted important early warning system and a good program evaluation measure for high schools, there are many ways and many interventions schools and districts can use to effect a positive change. In Chicago, there are strategies from phone calls home, tutoring, and mentoring. With the funding from the last biennium, the Oregon Department of Education supported a number of programs in Oregon under the general title Student Mentoring, Monitor, and Acceleration. Awardees across the state have designed programming that prepares 8th and 9th grade students for the rigor and planning needed to complete high school and be college and career ready. And we have promising practices in Oregon. Those include Redmond's Camp 9, which is an example of a program that's within a district that starts in the summer and permeates the whole ninth grade year. We also have Reaching and Empowering All People, known as REAP, and the Native American Youth and Family System, NAYA, which are programs delivered by community-based organizations that are culturally specific and help students beyond the school day. And then beyond grant-funded activities around Oregon, other districts are looking into different practices to prioritize scheduling full schedules or having smaller classes for 9th and 10th grade students. This comes at a cost, but the cost can be mitigated when students fail fewer courses, thus requiring fewer seats dedicated to retaking classes. The take-home message is that there are many methods to affect 9th grade on track, and the best for a particular school would differ from what's needed another school, and it depends on the local context. OEIB supports further research into what works for Oregon middle and high school students.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, my name is Brian Reeder. I'm the Assistant Superintendent in the Office of Research and Data Analysis at the Department of Education. Wanted to share with you today a little bit of the ongoing research that we've been doing at the department related to attendance and performance in school, and specifically most recently looking at high school graduation rates and the probability of students graduating from high school given their attendance records. I'll give you an overview here, and then I'll turn it over to my colleague Chelsea Clinton, who has done the most recent work here, and she can give you some of the details. If you look at the graph that we handed out, you can see sort of the dramatic relationship there, where the probability of getting a regular diploma in 4 years is on the vertical axis, and attendance rate on the horizontal. And just as an example, the difference between a 90% attendance rate and 100% attendance rate is a difference in expected graduation of about 15 percentage points. And that's huge. Of all the factors that we found in our research that affect high school graduation, attendance is one of the strongest and has one of the largest magnitudes. So with that, I'll turn it over to Chelsea, and then we can answer any questions you may have.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Chelsea Clinton. I'm a research analyst at the Oregon Department of Education. I wanted to just walk you through this model that Brian's begun to present here. It looks at the probability of earning a regular diploma in 4 years, and specifically it follows a cohort of students who began third grade in 2003-2004. It estimates the probability of earning that regular diploma in 4 years using a variety of factors. So it controls for things like gender, race, ethnicity, attendance, test scores, economic status, and a multitude of other things that we usually see in projects like this. We take In the model, we take the data from each year in a separate regression, essentially, so that we can look at the factors that affect students in each specific grade. That's why you have two graphs here. The 8th grade graph just includes the 8th grade data, and the 11th grade graph just includes the 11th grade data. As Brian explained, we have attendance on that horizontal axis in percentage points. And if you think about, break that down a little bit, if we assume 180-day school year, for example, that'd be 1.7 days. So you can see that between the ticks, that's about 3.5 days between each tick. So a pretty small amount of days absent, difference in absences there. And then we just look at that compared to the probability of earning a regular diploma isolated within the model I just described. And you can see that our female students who are not economically disadvantaged have the highest probability of earning that regular diploma. And I just wanted to point out that when you look at that line, it's relatively flat if you compare it to the male students who are economically disadvantaged, which is that bottom yellow line. So that suggests that attendance is even more important for those economically disadvantaged male students than it is for those female students, because they're getting a little higher probability for each increased percentage point that they're in school. And the same trends hold for that 11th grade year. As Brian explained, Peter were explaining, we're looking at absenteeism. We didn't estimate dropouts with this particular model, but we might think that if we did the model again, looking at predicting dropouts, that the same types of trends would hold. Lower attendance would lead to higher probability of dropping out.
Okay. Any questions? Representative Frederick.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. As we look at these studies, Summerbridge comes to mind for me, a program that was in Portland for quite a while. Brought eighth graders into the class during the summer and tried to make sure that they would get through ninth grade as well. There are a number of programs over the years that have been successful. Will we be looking at those past studies, or are we looking at trying to find a new program? What is the plan here?
Redmond Camp 9 that I mentioned is a summer bridge program, and I, as you have heard about the success of those, so I would assume that one is within the group that's considered a promising practice at the very least.
Thank you. Follow-up? Mm-hmm. Will we also be looking at some of the potential causes? We've had a significant disinvestment in education in Oregon over the last 25 to 30 years, certainly 25 years. Will that be used as a factor in that a number of places have no longer have the options that they once had for bringing kids into school and for kids wanting to come to school? The music programs, the sports programs that are now cost a fee, the arts programs, the science, after-school science programs, the shop and the career technical education programs that kept a lot of folks interested rather than just folks who were interested in the academics. Are we going to include that within the mix, or is it primarily just to see what numbers of kids are coming at particular times? I think there's a qualitative factor in here that I think is important.
Chair Doherty, Representative Frederick, I think clearly the work we do is always pointing towards understanding what are the causes of those, not just describing the situation, but trying to understand the causes. And as you mentioned, those are qualitative factors that, you know, aren't really expressed in some of the quantitative data that we gather. And so I think the next step is really to do more work in the field to understand what districts are actually doing, how funding may have had an impact on that over time. You're precisely correct that the funding in Oregon schools has declined dramatically over the last 25 years. Adjusted for inflation, around 25%. And what we've observed in that is loss of certain types of programs, loss of certain type of staff, counselors, for example, and trying to understand which of those may have contributed to disengagement by students, I think, is one of the next challenges that we have, and really probably one of the most promising areas to look.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Representative Hack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the lines of the counselors, I'm just curious, is that something that you'll be taking a look at, you know, our attendance and our dropout rates prior to the loss of our counselors and some of our truancy officers in our schools versus now, what it was then, what it is now? I have great concern about that, and I'm an advocate for having those folks in our building. So I'm just curious, are you going to look at what it was when we had those folks in our buildings and what it is now without them?
Chair Doherty, Representative Hack, we certainly can do that. One of the challenges we have with that is that if we go back more than about 10 years, we don't have this really rich student-level data anymore. But we certainly can look at the school and the district level to look at how that what that relationship looks like. It's very clear in the data that how we've lost certain types of staff over the last 25 years, and counselors is one of those.
Follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think even if you were to look back on, back even to 2008, 2009, when many of our districts still had those folks and now don't, I mean, I think that would even give us some sort of a picture into that. In addition, just curious to my follow-up actually was the increased numbers of students with disabilities as well, I know, factors into our absenteeism rates. And so I'm curious if you're going to take into consideration or look at the increased numbers of those students that we have in our populations. And again, not having counselors to help kind of ease the burden, you know, or looking at what are we doing with behavioral specialists? Do we have enough of those folks in our districts to take on that workload?
Chair Doherty, Representative Hack, we do look at special education students in our model, but we have not, as you suggested, and I think that's a great idea, is to look at some of the different types of staffing, even if we do it over the last 10 years where we have the good data, we might find some effects. So I appreciate that comment.
One quick follow-up. We've got lots to do today.
And then will you come back with a recommendation? Is that the goal of this, that you'll come back with recommendations as to what we do?
Chair Doherty, Representative Hack, we're happy to share what we find with the committee and with the wider legislature. And, if you have specific things that you'd like to bring back to you over the next few weeks or a couple months, we're happy to do that.
Thank you.
This is a clarification. This is a bill for a work group, and so you may want to be involved in that, and this is where we get the information.
Thank you
gathering.
Very much.
In fact, real quickly, again, part of the information, and Ms. Clinton, in the 11th grade versus the 8th grade, the female economically disadvantaged move up quite a bit.
Yes.
And the males go down. Is there any reason for that, or...
Chair Doherty, members of the committee.
I assume there is, but yeah.
I don't have a specific reason for you, but if you look at the graph very carefully, it looks like the female economically disadvantaged students are moving up quite a bit, where the male not economically disadvantaged students aren't really moving very much. So we just see a jump there in what those female students are doing.
Okay, maybe when we get into the minutia with the committee, that might be something that will be helpful.
Okay,
Representative, I'm sorry, Representative McLean.
This may just have something to do with the amendment that was, because I haven't seen it on OLA. So I guess Section 1 is where the amendment will take place. I didn't know for sure. Maybe somebody up here can't answer that, so I may have asked the wrong panel. Because what you guys talked about was methods and reporting, back during the interim. But on this, it talks about the ability. It says, including limiting the ability of a student to drop out of school. And I didn't hear any of you talk about that.
Chair Doherty,
I was going to say, can anyone answer that? If not, we can get an answer for you.
It's not clear to me exactly what was intended by that language, limiting the ability of a student to drop out of school. I'm assuming it doesn't mean shackles. So that's something that needs to be explored, and we're certainly willing to contribute to that discussion. On the issue of the amendment, if I understand it, I haven't seen the language, but it would add a provision where districts would report to the Department of Education what kind of actions they're taking to prevent dropouts.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Reardon.
Thank you. This is great work. And a lot of time we tend to look back at data from the past and you know, what were the programs that we're supporting over the last 10 years, 20 years. But as a former marketing person, I'd like to talk to the customer, potential customer, about what product they might enjoy. Would you see a robust survey of students as being maybe part of this work? Or not to make your life difficult.
I said one more thing.
Chair Daugherty, Representative Reardon, I think any effort to reduce dropouts really has to focus on students because, you know, if you look at the research that is out there that interviews students, the reasons for dropping out are there's just a really large number of them, and they're very nuanced. In Oregon, we used to ask districts to tell us why certain students dropped out, and it became clear to us that those data were the interpretation of educators, and sometimes they followed a discussion with the student, but sometimes they didn't. So it was speculation much of the time, and therefore not terribly useful in trying to evaluate what's really behind dropouts. So I would agree with you that discussions with students themselves is probably one of the most important things that needs to be done.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, this doesn't require a response, and there isn't an answer to this today. And mostly I'd direct this to you, quite frankly, Representative Taylor. What I would love to see come out of this this study, if indeed it moves forward, is not just third grade or sixth grade, but that we look at the method of delivery within those grades, whether it's a K-8, whether it's a middle school, whether it's a K-5, whether it's bricks and mortar, online. I think that those are very telling pieces to us as we look at this, is what is that environment. I would really like to see that piece, because we know a second grader in Portland is not the same as a second grader in Jordan Valley, and there's certainly different dynamics that go on there, and I think that'd be an important piece I'd like to see.
It's only Paul, right? Okay, thank you. Because I know kids I taught that dropped out, so not because of me, but I mean, there were two reasons that they used to tell me. One, they couldn't read, couldn't keep up with the work, and two, there was nothing for them to go to school for, because they didn't jump out of bed every morning and say, I want to go to English class. But it was welding, and it was metal shop, and it was auto, and it was band, and it was those kind of things. And also it was economic with a lot of the kids that I had. Okay, any other questions that we have? Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just wondering how large this survey was and if it covered all of Oregon, or the survey that you probability of earning a regular diploma.
Sure. Representative Daugherty, Representative Bredo. This comes right out of our student level collections at ODE, so it wasn't a survey. The cohort is right around just over 30,000 students in that graph.
From all over Oregon?
Correct.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much. I know we'll be hearing from you again. Okay. Iris, and then closes. Okay. Okay, Iris. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone.
Good afternoon.
Chair Daugherty, members of the House Education Committee, thank you for having me today. My name is Iris Maria Chavez. I'm the Government Affairs Director of Stand for Children. At Stand for Children, we have long been working to ensure that students have access to high-quality schools and education systems. We've also been working for quite some time around issues of attendance. We've worked in communities across the state with parents and advocates to help them be their students' first attendance monitor. We've worked with groups like the Children's Institute and the Chalkboard Project to look at practice and policy recommendations to increase student engagement and attendance in their schools. And we look forward to working with you all on House Bill 3319. The issue around dropout prevention and student engagement is really important, and we know that attendance, chronic absenteeism, is a leading indicator of student dropout. One of the things that we also know as a state is that much of the workforce that, or the jobs that we're developing here in the state, require at least some post-secondary training. Without a high school credential, you can't get that post-secondary training. And students who do receive that post-secondary training make, on average, around $260,000 less than their peers who receive their high school credential. Given all of those things that we do know, we know also that it's time to make systematic changes to help our schools engage students, reduce chronic absenteeism, and increase graduation rates. House Bill 3319 will help us look at what is going well in districts and schools across the state, give you as policymakers, us as advocacy organizations, the kind of information we need to make the smart decisions on systematic and individual supports to schools and districts. We look forward to working with you guys on this and thank Representative Taylor for really taking a comprehensive look at this issue. We know that there are a lot of pieces of legislation this session that are looking at attendance, chronic absenteeism, as well as this next step on dropout prevention. So together, I think that we're making some good work go on here.
Fine. Thank you. Any questions, Ms. Chavez? Hey, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We had no one else signed up for this issue. And seeing none, we will close. And before we close the hearing, I know that there's will be coordination probably with the group that's working on attendance, because attendance and dropouts go hand in hand. So there's a lot of the shared information and stuff that we'll have. So that will be in the works. Okay, with that, I close the public hearing on House Bill 3319. And do I have to get the suspension for this? We do have to suspend those.
Yeah, sure. Madam Chair,
yes.
I would ask that we could suspend the rules and allow Representative Peluso to vote on House Bills 3128 and 3336. It will not change the outcome.
Okay. Okay. Representative Springer moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of allowing Representative Peluso to vote on House Bill 3128 and House Bill 3336. Will not change the outcome of the vote. Is there any objection? Okay, seeing none. Tia, if you could.
Peluso?
Yes?
Okay, so the motion passes. Representative Peluso on House Bill 3128, how do you vote?
Aye.
Okay. And on Representative Peluso on House Bill 3336, how do you vote?
Aye.
Okay. Do I have to gambling out. Okay, the next thing we're going to have is a public hearing on House Bill 3389.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3389 establishes the Oregon Quality Education Model Modernization Task Force. It sunsets the task force 31st December 2016. It declares an emergency effective on passage, and the bill has a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay, thank you. Representative Evans.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Representative Evans, House District 20, Monmouth Independence, West Salem, South Salem. I'm going to be very brief. I was instructed by Representative Gallegos to be very, very brief, so here we go. The bill before you is really an attempt to dust off, update, and perhaps add to the Quality Education Commission, Quality Education model that was developed in the 90s. One of the things that, as a former school board member and someone that is trying to understand where we're going in education, I have no comment on the delivery process. That's way above my pay grade, and I know that people are working on that, that you are spending a lot of time trying to find the best ways to do that. However, I think to the taxpayers, to the folks in the school district, sometimes we wonder what exactly a school is anymore. How many kids to a teacher, whether or not there is an aide in the classroom, et cetera, et cetera. The quality education model was something that made sense to me in the 90s when it was developed. Unfortunately or fortunately, my military background comes into play on this. It reminds me of a table of operations and equipment. If I have a fighter squadron, I know how many fighters, I know how many engines, I know how many folks can maintain it. And that helps simplify for a lot of people what it is a school is, perhaps, and what it is a school can do. So the attempt here is to try to get a conversation going on, really, what is that model? And with the 3% on top of that model set aside for tailored economic development and workforce development. Again, it's not anything other than a conversation starter to try to modernize and look at how we currently teach in the 21st century. There has been some technological changes since the 1990s. There have been some other pressures put on us. But I think that conversation about structure is as important as some of the delivery mechanics. So that's really the hope for the task force, okay. And I appreciate the opportunity to make my case.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions about the task force? Okay, seeing none. Representative Evans, thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a wonderful day.
No one else was signed up. Is there anyone else who would like to speak on House Bill 3389? Okay, seeing none, I close the public hearing on House Bill 3389 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 3499. Representative Gallegos. Oh, would you like to? Richard,
thank you.
Please tell us what this bill is.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. House Bill 3499 directs the Department of Education to convene an advisory group related to English language learner, ELL, programs. It requires school districts to make an annual report to the Department of Education related to ELL programs. It adjusts methods by which the state school fund distributions are made to school districts for students enrolled in ELL programs. It declares an emergency effective 1st July 2015 and contains a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you.
Representative Gallegos. Deputy Thank Superintendent you, Chair Saxton. Doherty, Vice Chair Spenger, and Vice Chair Frederick, and committee. Thank you for having me. My name is Joseph Gallegos, for the record, and I am the House Representative for House District 30, which is referred to as the Silicon Forest or the economic engine of the state, whichever you choose to enjoy. Bill today, I mean, it's just really exciting to be here, literally. And I want to acknowledge that behind me are a number of members of the Coalition of Communities of Color. They're doing lobby day today, and so this is very nice that this is a bill that they'll be listening to. So let me just, I have a few words I'd like to share with you. As a lifelong Oregonian, I have witnessed the gradual but steady changes in the culture and ethnic demographics of our state. My first professional job, this is what, 1973, was that of a school counselor for the Portland School District, where my assignment was to counsel Latino and Native American families and students in the Portland School District. Later, I was a supervisor for a teacher corps program of bilingual, bicultural teaching students. And our mission was to infiltrate the Woodburn School District. And that was in an effort to implement the Bilingual Bicultural Bilingual Education Act of 1968. After that, I went on to join others in establishing a four-year degree-granting Latino college in Mount Angel, Oregon in 1974. And sort of the impetus for that college was the fact that 50% of the Latino students were not graduating from high school. And this is 1974, 50%, half of all the kids. Well, things have changed somewhat, others not so much. As a matter of equity, today, 40 years later, we have now 40% of our Latino students who are not graduating from high school, 40%. Yet, one out of four grade school kids in this state are Latinos. One out of four. In addressing ELL education, we not only address the needs of Latino students, but also Asian and Pacific Islander, Russian, and refugees from many, many other countries. who join the ranks of students who we are teaching in our schools as we strive to reach the goals of 40-40-20 in our state. We have strong models across the state of schools and districts that are excelling in ELL instruction. Our goal with this bill is to build a system so that all schools in the state have the tools needed to succeed. House Bill 3499 innovatively redefines the way in which we support our students, educators, and schools in the delivery of these ELL services. I am so impressed with the collaboration, partnership, and dedication that went into crafting this legislation. Folks were so committed to making sure we got it right, and through many conversations, a little compromise, and the shared interest in putting our students first, House Bill 3499 does get it right. And this will make a difference of success or failure of our students, and more critically, help us to reach our workforce needs in the near future. I'm to be followed by a number of people who will get into the technicalities of the bill, but I would personally just like to thank, and this is kind of like the Oscars, I'd like to thank Chuck Bennett, Morgan Allen, Lori Wimmer, Cindy Hunt, Ryan Fisher, Iris Chavez, and Joseph Santos Lyons, and many, many others who, for their collaboration and leadership for their various communities and solution-focused work ethic in crafting this phenomenal legislation. I am so proud. I think it could become a national model. And I am here. I'm free to answer any easy questions you might have.
Thank you, Dr. Gallegos. Mr. Saxton.
Chair Doherty, Vice Chair Springer, Vice Chair Frederick, members of the committee, for the record, Rob Saxton, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction. And it's an honor for me to be here today with Representative Gallegos around House Bill 3499. Just a little perspective, from my perspective anyway, would be that as long ago as last May, we began some work through OEIB on trying to think about how we would do some things differently around ELL students and improving outcomes for ELLs. And that morphed into some meetings in June with COSA, and then a great coalition of partners, including OEIB, OEA, APANO, Latino Network, Coalition of Communities of Color, Oregon Health Foundation, Chalkboard Stand, OEA, ODE, COSA, and OSBA. And there may be a few others that I left out, but there's only so many alphabet letters available. Working on this, and really we started off, I think, thinking about funding, and it really morphed into something very, with the components of 3499 included, I think that there is broad, at least tentative or complete support for on the member, on part of those groups. This would have $10 million that would have an advisory group come together that would identify school districts that are low performing with ELL students. And it would be the methodology for identification that that group would come forward with and make recommendations around that. They would also recommend the kind of technical assistance that would come forward for support of those school districts in an effort to improve outcomes for ELLs. And also a group would come together and recommend the reporting that would create a standard reporting for the 0.5 weight, which is approximately $160 million over the course of each biennium. The districts would then report their spending on a uniform code, on the uniform code developed by this group to the Oregon Department of Education, and low-performing school districts with up to as many as 33 schools would receive support based on the $10 million that I mentioned earlier. And then these schools and districts would receive support for approximately 4 years, after which the language says the department may offer additional guidance around the spending of the additional 0.5 weight. There would also be another $2 million for the rollout or scale up of the statewide ELL plan. This is a plan that multiple districts across the state created about 4 years ago and that we've been working to implement, but without a great resource. And we think there's a terrific opportunity here that would allow us to offer professional development for educators. I would offer as an example some resources that we had out of the strategic initiatives from the 2013 session that allowed us to create a massive online open course around effective implementation of ELL and instruction. We had over 5,000 individuals who signed up for that MOOC and quite a few who also finished the course. and then also the replication of high-quality model programs from across the state. I could mention a number of them, certainly, in David Douglas, the push-in model that they use, or the dual-language immersion program that they implement in Woodburn with great effect, with north of 90% of students graduating their four-year cohort. And so we think this is a great opportunity, and we're enthusiastic about what's contained in the bill. And I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I, too, have experts who can help me should you give me a stump. Thank you.
Do you have any questions of this panel? You guys did such a good job. We have no questions.
Great.
Thank you.
That's a pretty easy question, isn't it?
That was good so far.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you very much. Cindy, you want to come up? And then we have two more panels after that. Excuse me, Ms. Hunt.
My name is Cindy Hunt, the Government Legal Affairs Manager for the Department of Education, and I have the honor today of laying out the amendments that they're not in OLIS yet, but that will be coming to the bill, okay? Because I saw some of you trying to look at the bill as my boss, Rob Saxton, was talking and perhaps not finding what he was talking about. So I'm going to go over that part of it. So what the amendments do is, the first thing, there is the advisory group, and you heard reference to that. So the advisory group would be of stakeholders, kind of continuing some of the work that you heard Representative Gallegos and Rob talk about. The advisory group would provide advice to the department on naming the districts and those low-performing schools, both on, you know, how they would be named and the kinds of technical assistance that would be given. But the advisory group will not be starting from ground zero, because largely the school improvement efforts that are laid out, will be laid out in the amendment, will be based largely on the Focus and Priority School program, which I think I've had colleagues that have presented about that in the past. The second thing that the amendments will talk about is the uniform budget and coding and reporting, and you see that in the bill right now. One of the issues that came up in many of the work groups was just having good data, you know, from districts. And when we started looking at the data from the districts, there were certain districts, I'm looking at a certain representative who represents one of them, Representative Wilson, who, you know, based on what they're reporting, there's no way they were spending that little, you know. And so just getting at the data has proved as a challenge. And so some of the work that the advisory group will help with and the department will be doing in the next roughly 6 months-ish is developing uniform budget coding and reporting. So the third piece is the school improvement work, and you heard the prior speakers refer to this. So there would be districts that would be identified as low performing or targeted, and those districts would have roughly 33 schools that would need assistance, technical guidance, those kinds of things from the Department of Education, very much in the model of the Focus and Priority School model. You heard reference to the $10 million. That budget number was developed with 33 schools in mind and the Focus and Priority model in mind. You heard reference that after 3 to 4 years, if the schools did not show improvement or did not reach benchmarks established previously, then the department may start to say to the schools, okay, that money associated with the extra 0.5 weight for ELL students, we're going to tell you, you know, what you're going to be doing with that. But keep in mind, by the end of the 3 to 4 years, we will now have additional data from all the other districts, including some of our model districts and districts that are having, you know, more success in this area. So we'll be able to share that also with these districts who are targeted or low performing. The fourth thing that the amendments will do is that if you've been watching Ways and Means lately, they passed out the state school fund budget, the full committee, last Thursday, and there was reference as part of that to $12.5 million being carved out of the state school fund for ELL. But the actual carve-out is not in the appropriations bill that you all will be probably discussing later this week. It will be in this amendment. It's more of a substantive provision and that kind of thing. So you'll see a carve-out, and so that would provide ongoing funding for this work. Remember I mentioned that these schools will be in school improvement for 3 to 4 years. So this will provide the ongoing, you know, necessary funding. As part of that funding, it'll be the rollout of the state ELL plan that Rob mentioned, and staffing completely will be taken care of by that amount of money. The fifth piece of the amendment is that in the bill, or in the bill as it was introduced, there's the timing of it is sort of a longer time period. The amendment will condense that. And what I mean by that is the advisory group will be up and running in the summer. They will be providing advice. Rules will be adopted in the fall. And then by January-ish, beginning of next year, those schools will be identified. And then the districts will be doing planning next year. And then rolling that out through implementation by the 16-17 school year. So it's an aggressive timeline, and you'll see that reflected in the amendments as well. And then finally, the thing that the amendments will do, you've probably heard perhaps some talk in the building about 4 and 7 years and like an alteration of the state school funding formula around that. This bill currently has that. The amendments remove that element in favor of these other pieces. And like I said, that's been worked on by the work group. So with that, I'm open for questions.
Okay, great. Thank you. And the amendments have not been, we don't have an old list yet. They've not been gone through yet.
Okay. Correct.
So we'll just be waiting. Yep. Any questions, Ms. Hunt?
Thanks.
Okay, great. Thank you very much for explaining that. And we'll be waiting for the amendments. Okay, the next panel we have is Carmen Rubio, Weiwei Liu, and Alexandria Berrigan.
Good afternoon, Chair Doherty and members of the Education Committee. My name is Carmen Rubio, and I'm here in my role as Executive Director of Latino Network and also as the co-chair of the Coalition of Communities of Color. I'm here to express my support and the support of an additional 20 member organizations that make up the Coalition of Communities of Color for HB 3499 and the consensus agreements reached last week. For the past 2 years, the Oregon Alliance of Education Equity, with the Coalition of Communities of Color and numerous other nonprofit organizations, education institutions, and advocates, have been investing our time, advice, and community voice into the development of this crucial initiative. The need is clear. Many of us here today have heard or can share multiple stories about how our current system isn't serving our kids. We know we can do better than Oregon's 49% ELL graduation rate. And with only 29% of ELLs meeting fourth grade reading benchmarks, a critical indicator for literacy success in later grades, we know we have to do better. This session, with your leadership and your support, will have the ability to turn this crisis into a moment of tremendous and unprecedented opportunity in Oregon. As a student growing up in Hillsboro, my school friends and I, like others around the state, have experienced a flawed ELL system. Now is our chance for our state to get it right and to demonstrate the leadership that will move this state forward by decades. Because when provided with quality English language instruction, ELL students can outperform state averages in high school graduation, college attendance, and college completion. These students represent tremendous potential for Oregon to achieve 40-40-20's key education and workforce goals. These children are our future workers, neighbors, and leaders. In the next 10 years, Latinos will be an even more significant part of the economic base in Oregon. Yet our whole state loses if this growth outpaces our educational institutions' ability to be appropriately responsive. This is why HB 3499 is a timely and important step toward building a new education model for today's students, not just for ELL Latino youth, but all children in Oregon. We thank our education partners and Representative Gallegos for pursuing the concept developed in HB 3499. These are the changes that families I work with every day have been asking for a very long, long time. We believe this initiative will have a tremendous impact on ELLs and are very much in support of the $12.5 million allocation for ELL currently proposed in the budget. On behalf of the many families, children, and advocates, I urge you to please support this important bill moving forward. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Wu?
Dear members of the education,
and you don't have to be so close. Perfect.
Okay. My name is Weiwei Liu. I'm the ESL director from the Beaverton School District. I'm also the co-president of the Oregon Council of Title III Directors. Just for your information, Title III stands for ESL. I'm here to support the House Bill 3499. that focuses on the urgent needs of English language learners who perform at the bottom of the achievement gap among student groups. As the fastest growing student population, English language learners face multiple risk factors such as lack of English language proficiency, poverty, lack of cultural background, and lack of foundational knowledge of U.S. schools. We're excited that this bill starts to address the system needs and issues concerning English language learners in the state of Oregon. The state of Oregon has the obligation to support and embrace the increasing numbers of English language learners and immigrants who have the potential to be Oregon's economic powers in the next few years and decades. Coming from more countries or hundreds of countries and speak hundreds of languages, English language learners and their parents are part of Oregon's diverse community and part of Oregon's workforce. Our ability to speak another or other languages is a great asset to enrich Oregon's future economy and to contribute to Oregon's wealth. The people of Oregon have the obligation to make a commitment to include English language learners and immigrants as part of Oregon's future. Such a commitment must include sufficient funding to eliminate the resource gap and to ensure that English language learners have adequate time and plenty of opportunities to acquire the English language and successfully access the content knowledge. The educational systems in the state of Oregon have the responsibility to take on the full ownership of English language learners and to provide an inclusive learning environment free of discrimination, where English language learners are respected, valued, and recognized for their ability to speak multiple languages. It is the responsibility of the Oregon schools to ensure that all English language learners are able to speak and utilize our own native language in all content classes. Speaking one's native language is a civil right. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Alexander, before you continue, we're actually going to open up a concurrent hearing with House Bill 3423. So we'll do that. Richard will talk about what it is, and then we'll continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3423 is a related yellow bill. It modifies requirements for English language learners. It declares an emergency effective on passage, and Ms. Berrigan asked to testify to both simultaneously. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Alejandra Barragan, and I'm a Spanish bilingual kindergarten teacher at Alder Elementary in the Reynolds School District. As an active participant, I participated in a work group at the invitation of the Oregon Education Association to develop a legislative concept that would help to improve the academic achievement and English language proficiency of Oregon's ELL students. That group, which met between October and January, produced the first draft of what would become HB 3423. This was to be a work group that included community-based organizations, educators in ELL, and bilingual programs, and representatives of various education organizations. After the first draft was developed, OAA met with other community group leaders to improve the bill further, adding such elements as early identification and stronger parent outreach elements. This bill is something that is very close to me. My school district has attempted to have a bilingual program for the past 20 years. At one point in the past 5 years, we were told that we did not have a bilingual program by our ELL department. I am now part of a one-way immersion K-1 pilot program at my school district, although they have been trying to have a bilingual program for the past 20 years. And if you ask our coworkers, they do have a bilingual program. As the teachers who are supporting these language learners in their own language, we feel we are not being successful because it takes too long for us to find out whether we will be receiving resources, professional development, program definition, or simply when is the next bilingual meeting. More importantly, if school districts do not have a clear plan or are not held accountable, those who are suffering are our students and the families who believe that we are doing the best for the education of our children. The school district I work for has good programs, but lacks accountability.
I was an EL student from kindergarten to second grade, but was exited quickly. I was a student who only needed some supports. Many students like myself are in our schools because they are able to pick up a second language more rapidly, or district schools have created programs or supports that are successful for English language learners. Unfortunately, programs across our state, districts, and even schools are not uniform. I wanted to give a couple of personal examples from my brothers. My youngest brother was able to exit an Oregon ELL program before entering elementary. But my middle brother, he was an ELL learner, since he was 2 years old. He was he has a communication disorder at 2 years old, was not able to learn to speak till he was five. So he struggled. Early education, Head Start, K-12, and even his first year at a community college. And we, as Spanish-speaking family, my mother didn't really understand what was going on. I had to be the interpreter for her and didn't really understand what was going on. And now as an educator, I know, okay, so that's what we could have done before, but we can't turn the clock back. He received mainly his support through the K-5, but as he moved up in the grades, that support began to decline. And even now when he entered a community college, which is, I think, is also something we should consider, is that if it wasn't because I went with him to a community college and to the advisors, I don't know if he would have gotten the supports or the classes he actually needed. There are many reasons that exist about why HB 3423 could greatly benefit our students, but as a teacher and having gone through the experiences of having ELL in my own family, I am supportive of a way to make sure school districts are held accountable, that our English language learner programs that they are creating are actually working. I am supportive of districts receiving support in ways of grants or additional funds to make sure students are receiving the services they need. As a bilingual educator, I know, and if we look at the research, students who are fully supported in a two-way immersion classrooms, and by this I mean staffing, materials, professional development, and district-wide supports are the most successful. I am in support of holding districts accountable for educating parents about ELL and making them aware of students' progress in all forms necessary. And I am supportive of school districts having homework assistance, K-12. And I am supportive of a task force that will look at what is best for our ELL students, not on how they can exit a program sooner, but how they can become learners in a mainstream classroom or continue benefiting from a bilingual program. We, as educated adults, need to be more aware of our students' rate of learning. I am in support of HB 23, or how it may be amended into HB 34. $4.99, if it means that we will consider our students as human beings and not bodies in the classroom. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions on this panel? Okay, thank you so much. Okay, the next one we have Abdullah Fofana and Maria Delgado. Abdul, do you want to move over there? So, yeah, we've got. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
For the record, my name is Abdul Fofana. I'm originally from Sierra Leone, West Africa, and I currently reside in Portland, Oregon, and I've resided there for the last 15 years. And I'm currently working for Center for Intercultural Organizing as a parent organizer. And as a parent organizer, our job is to empower underrepresented communities and underrepresented families, and empowering those families so that they could be more involved in their students' education. I want to first of all start by thanking you, the chair lady, and the rest of the members. And my purpose here is to get your support so that we can move this bill forward. As an immigrant who came to this country, my family and I immigrated here so that we can have a better life and we can have a better education. And so when I came, ELL classes were very, very necessary for me because they provided me with the support and the help that I needed so I can catch up and I can also acculturate into the American school culture. But let me first of all state that in my country of origin, Sierra Leone, English is our national language. So I spoke English already in Sierra Leone before I came to America. So the help and the support that I mainly needed was just to be able to sort of adjust my British English to American English. And so after the first 3 or 4 years in the ELL class, I was doing so well that I became a teacher's aide. And I was one of the students that were helping the students that came from a background where they didn't speak any English at all. And so as I spent more time in the ELL class, I became more and more proficient. I felt more comfortable speaking, reading, and writing English. And this was also reflected with the grades that I was getting at the time. And so after I spent 2 more years in the ELL class, when I moved from Washington, D.C. to Portland at Jefferson High School, shortly after, my parents bought a home in Southeast Portland. And then I moved to David Douglas High School as a junior. And I was also put in an ELL class when I got there. And so at my senior year, my parents felt that I no longer needed this class, and I also felt like it wasn't necessary for me to be in that class because I was doing really well. But the school insisted that I stayed in the class, and I stayed in it until I graduated, and then also when I went to Mount Hood Community College, I also took an ELL class there. So as I became more and more socially acculturated and started making friends, I quickly learned that being in an ELL class had a stigmatization that came with it, that I was not as smart as everyone else. And as a kid who was trying to fit in into this culture, that really affected my self-esteem and how I looked at myself. And it made it not fun for me to want to come to school. And the fact that I didn't feel like I could defend myself, it really affected how I looked at myself until I got much older, and then I learned the skills to be able to analyze myself and realize that I was just as smart as anyone else. And so now let's fast forward to 2015. So as a parent organizer, the first things that we're doing is we're actually calling all the families that we want to empower, and we had a listening session so we can hear from them about what are the most pressing needs and what are the most barriers that they have that are stopping them from being involved with the schools. And so in the first listening session that we had, one of the Latino families that we have in the program, she was really, really upset that her daughter, who was born in Portland, who has never left Portland, never been to Mexico, is in an ELL class. And her frustration was the fact that she didn't feel like she had the English skills, and with the work schedule that she had, she couldn't go to the school and advocate for her parents. So this was like the main thing that she brought to me as a concern for her. And so I bring that to your attention to let you know that this issue is very real, and it's affecting our communities. It's affecting the self-esteem of our children. It's affecting the academic successes of our children and the graduation rates of our children. And evidence-based research has proven that those ELL programs that are able to exit students out in less than 8 years are more successful. And I'm an example of one of those students. This is the reason why I'm able to be here and sit in front of you guys today. And so I am urging for your support so that we can move this bill forward. Thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Miembros del you want to see the microphone can be this far away. Gracias.
Miembros del Comité de Educación.
Members of the House Education Committee.
Buenas tardes, mi nombre es María Delgado.
Good afternoon, my name is María Delgado.
Estoy aquí hoy como madre de dos hijos.
I'm here today as a mother of two children.
Líder de la comunidad y miembro de STAND.
Community leader and member of STAND.
Yo pertenezco a un grupo de padres líderes de STAND for Children.
I belong to a group of parent leaders of STAND for Children.
Y nosotros estamos muy preocupados por los niños que no alcanzan sus metas académicas y lingüísticas.
And as parents, we are very concerned about the children that do not reach their academic and language goals while in ELL programs.
Mientras están en el programa de ELL. Yo agradezco que ustedes como líderes estatales presten atención a este tan importante tema.
Thank you, state leaders, for paying attention to this important issue.
Y quieran encontrar soluciones para que estos niños tengan las mismas oportunidades de éxito académico que otros niños.
And wanting to find solutions so that these children too have the same opportunities as others to reach their highest academic potential.
Yo, como ya les dije, yo tengo dos hijos.
As I said, I have two children.
Mi hija está en el grado 9 y mi hijo en el grado 11.
My daughter is a freshman and my son is a junior in high school.
Mi sueño para mis hijos es que logren graduarse y tengan un mejor futuro.
My dream is for my children to graduate from high school so that they have a better future.
Ya que yo no lo tuve la oportunidad de avanzar en los estudios.
Because I did not have the same academic opportunities.
El mismo sueño que yo tengo para mis hijos es el mismo sueño que muchos padres tienen.
The same dream that I have for my children is the same dream many parents have.
Nosotros vivimos en el condado de Multnomah y el día de hoy estoy aquí hoy para el apoyo a la propuesta HB 3499.
We live in East Multnomah County and I am here today in support of House Bill 3499.
La razón por la que yo y mis compañeros estamos apoyando la propuesta,
the reason why I and my colleagues are supporting this proposal,
es porque tenemos experiencias dentro del programa por nuestros propios hijos.
It's because we have personal experiences with the ELL program with our own children.
Me gustaría compartir mi experiencia con mi hija.
I would like to share my experience with my daughter.
La cual está en el grado 9.
Who is in the ninth grade.
Ella estuvo en el ELL desde que inició la escuela hasta hace 2 meses cuando la saqué del programa.
She was in ELL her entire school career until 2 months ago when I pulled her out of the program.
Yo la saqué porque no estaba en las clases que la iban a llevar hacia la graduación y ni la universidad.
I did this because she was not taking classes that were putting her on track to graduate or to go to college.
Mi hija estaba tomando demasiados electivos, incluyendo 2 clases de ELL. Y muy pocas clases que la llevarían hacia la graduación.
My daughter was taking too many electives, including 2 ELL classes and very few core classes.
Muchas veces los estudiantes son olvidados en el sistema.
I believe that many times students are forgotten in the system.
Y no son expuestos a otras clases.
And are not exposed to other classes.
Hay veces que los sacan de clases regulares para ofrecerles ELL.
Sometimes they are taken out of regular classes to provide ELL.
Y pierden clases académicas.
And lose academic classes when that is not necessary.
Cuando eso no es necesario. Esto no es algo que apenas está ocurriendo hoy.
This is not something that is happening just today.
Sabemos de muchas historias de estudiantes que estuvieron en este programa en los años 90. Sin embargo, hoy sigue la misma historia con otros estudiantes, así como a mi hija.
We know of many stories of students who were in the program in the 90s, and yet today is the same story with other students like mine.
Cuando yo hablé con el director y le dije que iba a sacar a mi hija del programa,
when I talked to the principal and told him I was going to take my daughter out of the program,
él me respondió que mi hija necesitaba el programa.
He replied that my daughter needed the program.
A los días volví a hablar con el director y le dije lo mismo.
A few days later, I went to talk to the principal again and told him the same thing.
Su respuesta fue, ya hemos hablado de esto y ella necesita.
His response was, we have already talked about this and she needs it.
Yo le dije que no creía que lo ocupaba.
I told him I did not believe it.
Pero insistía que yo la dejara.
And he insisted I leave her in the program.
Entonces, yo le pedí que me firmara un documento donde él me garantizara que mi hija se iba a graduar de la high school e iba a llegar a la universidad estando en el programa de ELL.
So I asked him to sign a document where he assured me that my daughter was going to graduate from high school and was going to go to college while in the ELL program.
Y la respuesta de él fue,
and then his response was,
en el momento que usted quiera, la puede sacar.
You can remove your daughter from their program whenever you'd like.
Y en ese momento la saqué del programa.
That's when I chose to opt her out of services.
Yo no estoy en contra del programa ELL.
I am not against the program ELL.
Al contrario, es muy bueno. Y puede ser más bueno si en realidad se aseguran de que estos niños estén avanzando.
In fact, it is a very good program and be even better.
Necesitamos programas de alta calidad.
We need high quality programs that ensure
menos tiempo innecesario.
That ensure children aren't wasting time.
Y los distritos necesitan más apoyo para que ayuden a los estudiantes a avanzar y salir exitosos de ELL.
And districts need more support to help students move in and out of ELL successfully.
Yo creo que todos los educadores quieren lo mejor para todos los niños, y creo que este es el momento para hacer la diferencia juntos.
I think all teachers want the best for all children, and I think this is the time to make a difference together.
Gracias por su tiempo, porque también reconocemos que no es fácil tomar estas decisiones.
Thanks for your time, because we also recognize that it is not easy to make these decisions.
Pero sí se puede.
Sí se puede.
Yo sé que ustedes están pensando en los más de 55,000 niños que están en el programa de ELL.
I know you are thinking of the more than 55,000 children in Oregon that are receiving ELL services.
Y que van a hacer todo lo posible por mejorar la situación para ellos y todos los niños de las escuelas públicas.
I know you will do everything possible to improve the situation for them and all children in public schools. Thank you.
Gracias. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any questions of this panel? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony.
Just thank you.
Thank you. That's all we have signed up for the two bills. Anyone else want to speak on either 3423 or 3944? 3499. Okay, seeing none, I will close the work session or the public hearing on 3423, and also on, I close the work session on, or the hearing on 3499. Okay. With that, I open up a public hearing on House Bill 3375. Representative Frederick. And Richard.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3375 revises and renames the Minority Teacher Act of 1991.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. You're clearing the House, Representative Frederick.
I did. they don't want to hear from me again. I understand.
Nothing personal.
Oh, I don't know.
But you have some people coming up to help you. So. I was going to say also that would be Hilda Rosselli and Thank you. Okay, everybody. Frederick.
Everybody out?
No, not yet.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, I'm Representative Lou Frederick from House District 43, North and Northeast Portland. I participated over the past year in what started out as a Minority Educators Advisory Group and became the Educator Equity Advisory Group. The fact that we changed the name of the advisory group is reflected in the recommendations we're making to revise and rename the Minority Teachers Act of 1991. 24 years on, the problems have changed somewhat. We are looking at the problems differently, and we are looking ahead to craft a law that will work for us in the future. Others are here to walk you through the bill, but the main thrust is to replace references to minority teachers, educators, or students with references to diversity and equity. Amendments have been requested to replace references to number of diverse educators or students with percentages. The newly stated goal will be, as a result of this state's commitment to equality for the diverse peoples of this state, the goal of this state is that the percentage of diverse educators employed by school districts and education service districts reflects the percentage of diverse students in the public schools of this state. Our state, as everyone knows, is changing. Our country is changing. Our world is changing. In aggregate, those who we refer to as minorities may, in fact, soon not represent a minority of our students, of our citizens. However, the advantages and disadvantages that have developed around majority and minority status, as well as historical conditions, are cumulative and are likely to require specific actions to remedy for the foreseeable future if we are real about reaching the goal of equal opportunity for all. Education is one of the places that needs to happen, because teachers, actually all who make up the schoolhouse, are professional role models, present in students' lives every day, and in addition to everything they do. Investment in a diverse generation of educators is a step, a critical step, to address the cumulative causation that makes it harder for some parts of our community to succeed. I look forward to the day when we no longer couple the terms poor students and students of color as if they are necessarily linked. I will leave it to others to go through exactly what the bill will do in terms of implementation and follow-up, but I want to thank you all. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, thank you.
Chair Dougherty and Representative Springer and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Hilda Rosselli. I serve as the College and Career Readiness Director for the Oregon Education Investment Board, and as such, I had the pleasure and honor to convene a group that has helped advise the work that started with Senate Bill 755 that reinvigorated the 1991 Minority Teacher Act. And I thought it would be helpful for you to understand a little bit about where we are and why we came to a point of recognizing some areas for improvement in the bill, and that has resulted in House Bill 3375. First of all, we have completed the first status report on the Minority Teacher Act, as was provided in Senate Bill 755, and there were some new changes that came about. For example, for the first time, we were actually beginning to track persons whose first language was not English, and in fact, we're still building some of the systems in the universities to be able to get that data accurately. What this also did was it coincided with some strategic investments that the advisory group that Representative Frederick referenced and serves on have been able to monitor over time, particularly in the areas of pipeline production, retention, and some clinical education models that are being supported. And my colleague, Markeisha Smith, is here to address that. She also will probably need to give you just a glimpse on what has changed at the federal level while we were in the midst of all of this work, because it has defined some new plans and requirements for the states. I would, however, like to just summarize briefly a couple of specifics that came up as we began to do the first report in 2014 that have led to some of the recommendations. First of all, the term that is in Senate Bill 755 references teachers, and yet when you dig deeper in, we are really reporting on administrators as well as teachers. And in fact, we think we can also include instructional assistants because they create a pipeline for our educator workforce, and we also could include some of those individuals like guidance counselors. If we move beyond that into many of the other types of positions, we can't capture that accurately. So that was one of the changes. Representative Frederick already gave you the compelling reasons why we would like to see the title of the report changed and to start using different language besides minority. This, however, does make some changes around the goals, but we've also begun to think about what is our big goal and then how do we meet that goal, because what we found was that the 10% growth over 2012, we were able to meet that in two of the three categories. We're on track. And we felt like maybe the goal is not high enough. We also acknowledged in talking to the districts that there's a big difference in districts that have a large percentage of students that are culturally and linguistically diverse versus some that do not. And we felt like the percentage could be set according to a goal based on the district numbers of K-12 students. And lastly, we wanted clarity to make sure that this became an important annual report that we provided to you. It gives us more of a focus to keep the movement forward on getting accurate data. We did identify a couple of data sources that were not accurate. For example, the original bill asked for the number of candidates applying to educator prep programs. And what we know is that particularly at the Master of Arts and teaching level,
people apply to multiple programs and then they pick one. So what we think is a better indicator for you is to give you the enrollment data, who's actually enrolled in the program. And lastly, there were some technical changes, for example, eliminating references to the Oregon University system and also including our pre-K educator group. So we are going to be adding a new member to our advisory group, and we'll be starting to collect data on that area. In addition to that, I'm referencing some feedback that I got from Portland Public Schools, referencing just to make sure that we use the words percentage rather than numbers, and also to make sure that we link this work to the federal report that Markeisha Smith will explain to you now.
Hey, good afternoon, everyone. Representative Daugherty, Representative Springer, members of the committee. My name is Markeisha Smith, and I serve as the director of the Oregon Department of Education Equity Unit and also a member of the Oregon Educator Equity Advisory Group. It's a mouthful. And as Hilda has mentioned, one of the things that came up rather quickly across our table was federal guidance from the U.S. Department of Education in fall of 2014 that is requiring all states to create equitable access to educator plans. And so what that means for us as a department is that on June 1st, we have to submit our plan to the U.S. Department of Education and how we intend to hold districts accountable for how they are considering equitable access to educators, particularly for populations of diverse students, for English learners, for students living in poverty, and how we will monitor that going forward. And so this really seemed like a very natural place in thinking about amendments to the bill to add this information and, you know, making sure that we are holding districts accountable in terms of their recruitment, hiring, and retention of diverse educators. And so this will be a natural extension of the work that we're doing at the department for that plan.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions of the panel? Representative Peluso.
I apologize. I have forgotten your name already.
Hilda Bracelli.
Thank you so much. So you were listing off, categories of individuals, and I wonder where volunteers might fall in that. I always get concerned about some populations that feel alienated from even volunteering at their schools. So I don't know if that fits in this or not, but just to throw that out.
Okay. Chair Daugherty and Representative Peluso, it's a good question. I think one of the things we've discovered, though, is that the type of data collection about the individuals who are in the educator workforce is based on licensure data and employment data from the Oregon Department of Education. And that means that we don't have to go to every single school to collect that information. And, you know, that gives it a systems approach to making sure that we can collect that annually. I believe that tracking volunteers would be a much larger process. I'm glad that we can do instructional assistants because I think they do indicate interest often in becoming teachers. And so I didn't mention that we're actually getting ready to launch a statewide educator website that will have recruitment information, particularly addressing teachers who are bilingual, teachers who are culturally diverse, and it will give an opportunity for us to find those individuals interested, whether they be in an instructional assistant position or even in K-12 and trying to find out information about how to become a teacher.
Can I do a follow-up there, Madam Chair? So I really appreciate that and putting that in that perspective because it is important that the data is accurate, those sorts of things. And perhaps, again, on the volunteer type stuff, we just encourage our districts to take a more active role in being sure our schools are welcoming. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Rudin.
Hilda, could you tell us a little bit briefly about this statewide website a little bit more? And is that an OEIB website?
It is. Representative Rudin and Chair Daugherty and members of the committee. This grew out of a concern as we looked across matters like the Minority Teacher Act and also strengthening our educator prep programs, which was a result of House Bill 3233 in the Network for Quality Teaching and Learning, that we really needed one place that was official to find information about how to become an educator. This would allow us to target the kinds of groups that we want to reach, whether it be career changers, people who bring an industry background, individuals who are already enrolled in a college who might need to know where the high-need jobs are. So it's really bringing together a lot of entities to host one official website.
Really glad to hear that, because that's, I've just been trying to get some information about the career changer types, and
yes,
I think we found the right spot. So
yes, good. Absolutely. I'm ready to work with you on that.
Good.
Okay. Follow up?
Nope.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great website. Any other questions, comments? Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. With that, those were the only people signed up for the bill. Is there anybody else who would like to speak on 3375? Okay. If not, I'll close the public hearing on 3375. And that's it for business for the day. Adjourn the meeting.